In October 1962, President John F. Kennedy told the American public some alarming news about Cuba.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Missiles at those bases, he said, would threaten American cities, and the U.S. could not let that happen.
To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
For the next several days, the world braced for nuclear war. Ultimately, Kennedy and Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev stood back from the brink. The Cuban Missile Crisis has been the subject of books and movies ever since. Even so, a new book about it by Michael Dobbs includes a lot of new detail, and as Dobbs says, he takes a broad view of the missile crisis that's quite different from many prior accounts.
A lot of focus was on the confrontation between Kennedy and Khrushchev. And I really came to the conclusion that, particularly toward the end of the crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev were on pretty much on the same side. They were both trying to get out of this terrible mess that they had in part helped create. And the real risk of nuclear war did not come from the decisions of Kennedy and Khrushchev. It came from the accidental chance events that happen when you put the machinery of war into motion.
And it happened that on the very day that would qualify as the most dangerous day of the Cold War, an American U-2 pilot gets lost over the Soviet Far East.
Right, that's a very good example of the kind of unpredictable chance events that happen once you start going to war. The Strategic Air Command was sending high-level U-2 reconnaissance planes to the North Pole on a perfectly routine basis to monitor Soviet nuclear tests. And as chance would have it, one of these U-2s went off to the North Pole. The pilot was blinded by the Aurora Borealis, and he stumbles over the Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the Cold War. The next day, Khrushchev wrote to Kennedy and said, "We could have mistaken this plane for a nuclear bomber, and it could have caused a nuclear exchange between our two countries."
There are moments during this time when we think we know what happened. I mean, lore has been passed down to us, and there's a famous moment in Washington when John F. Kennedy's Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, has some news of the blockade, and he remarks famously, "We went eyeball to eyeball, and they blinked."
Yes, that's probably the most famous quote from the missile crisis. And like several other incidents, it's really based on myth. I was the first researcher to actually plot the positions of Soviet and American warships. This was on October 24th, 2 days after Kennedy had imposed the blockade. And I found out that they were 400 or 500 nautical miles apart at this moment. So there was no risk of an American interception of a Soviet missile-carrying freighter. They turned around early on the 23rd. This is a day later on the 24th when they're already heading back toward the Soviet Union.
One lesson for JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis is that he had earlier been trying to get the military to remove obsolescent or obsolete missiles from Turkey, which turned out to be the bargaining chips in the end with Moscow. They'd take their missiles out of Cuba. The U.S. would take missiles out of Turkey. Kennedy had been wanting the military to do it. They just wouldn't do it. I mean, the U.S. military wouldn't comply with his policies.
Well, I think he never actually gave them a direct order. Mac Bundy, at one point, the National Security Advisor, says there's a difference between a presidential wish and a presidential order. And in the end, Kennedy sends Bobby to the Soviet embassy on the night of Black Saturday, October 27th, and essentially offers the Soviets a deal, saying that if you bring your missiles out of Cuba, we will bring those missiles out of Turkey, but the deal has to be kept secret. During the crisis, he had read Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, about the origins of the First World War. And the thing that struck him about that book was that nobody really understood why the world was plunged into war in 1914. And he was determined that if the world had to face a nuclear war, there would be very, very clear reasons for fighting it. that could be explained to ordinary Americans, and a few obsolete missiles in Turkey was not sufficient reason for him to go to war.
One thing that's, I think, that which you achieve in the book, which is it's a reminder here, is that the United States in 1962 was in a very different situation with respect to the world than it is today. This was 15, 16 years after the end of the Second World War. Victories had been achieved. I guess Korea was a stalemate, but the military felt very, very confident of itself. And these were people who, but let's get it over with.
The United States undoubtedly enjoyed extraordinary nuclear superiority over the Soviet Union back in 1962, and a number of senior military people, including Curtis LeMay, the Air Force chief, thought that we could fight and win a nuclear war against the Soviet Union and were prepared to contemplate such a war. Kennedy's calculation was very different. He asked the military, how many casualties would there be if just one Soviet missile got through? And he was told about 500,000. And his reaction to that was, you know, that was the number of casualties we had in the Civil War, and it's taken us almost a century to get over that. So, you know, we might win a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, but it'll be a victory that is pretty meaningless.
And as you know, toward the end of the book, in the end, both Kennedy and Khrushchev bring the world back from the brink of nuclear war.
Right. I discovered a letter that Jackie Kennedy wrote to Khrushchev after her husband's assassination, saying that there were many things that divided you two as leaders, but you wanted to preserve the peace. And in the end, my husband used to say that it was not the big men that cause wars, it's the small men. And I think in that sense, both Kennedy and Khrushchev were big men, and the real risk of nuclear war in October 1962 came from the small men, as Jackie said, not the big men.
Michael Dobbs, thank you very much for talking with us. Michael Dobbs, the author of 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War.
There is a black and white photograph that's one of the most enduring images of the Great Depression. It's called Migrant Mother. It shows a poor farm worker, her hand touching her lips in worry. Two ragged children clutch her shoulders, and a baby is wrapped in cloth in the mother's lap. This photo was taken by Dorothea Lange. A new book documents hundreds of Lange's photos of the Dust Bowl and the Depression, and the description she wrote of them. It's called Daring to Look. The author is Anne Whiston Spern, and she joins us now from WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
That image called Migrant Mother is one of the most reproduced photographs in history. Dorothea Lange took it in California in 1936. She had a job working for one of the New Deal agencies, the Farm Security Administration. I wonder, why did the government send out photographers to those places?
In the beginning, the first job of the photographers was to show the conditions that existed across the country. Then, as the 1930s went on and the government programs had been implemented, her job shifted to photographing the success, presumably, of these programs. Of course, Lange, being Lange, found that things weren't working out in the field quite as well as the bureaucrats would like. So she took photographs by 1939, not only of the successful programs, but also of conditions that continued to persist.
You focus on the year 1939, after she took Migrant Mother. Why 1939?
In 1939, she started writing longer reports to go with her photographs, which are really stories from the field.
Would you turn to one of those photos?
Sure.
Describe for me the picture, if you would, and then read for me from Dorothea Lange's notes.
Well, there's a picture of a woman named Queen. And along with Queen is a group of her fellow farm wives ranged across the steps to the church. And Lange says, women of the congregation on the church steps with brooms and buckets. Date, July 5th, 1939. Subject, annual cleaning up day at Wheelie's church. Accidentally learned at Gordonton that everybody in the community was gathering at the church, going to take their dinner. Farm women of all ages, men and children, 1 6-month-old baby and 1 woman on 2 crutches were still there finishing up the cleaning at about 2:30. Had to talk to the head deacon to get permission to photograph. They very much want to have a print showing the church and the grounds, very proud of their church, spacious, well-shaded churchyard, and very proud of the fact that they keep everything so tidy.
We came across a quote of Dorothea Lange talking about what motivates her. She said, "No country has ever closely scrutinized itself visually that I know of. I know what we could make of it if people only thought we could dare look at ourselves." What's your favorite picture?
Oh, I have so many. I think that one of my very favorites is this photograph from Yakima, Washington, of a little boy and his sister. They're camped with their family along the Yakima River, and the little boy, who can't be more than about 3 or 4 years old, has his arm around his sister, who is just a little bit littler than him. And there's this big roll of something that just comes up from the upper left and straight across the photograph. And when I first saw it, I thought, gosh, what's that? Seems to me like the topic of the photograph is this gesture of these two small children with this in front of this truck piled with possessions. And then Lang tells us, when you read the story, that this family is from Oklahoma. They have 9 children. They've been on the road for 3 years. And then she says, still carrying a roll of kitchen linoleum.
Oh, wow.
Wow. That roll of linoleum is the memory of home and the hope for a new home. And once you read that in her story, the roll of linoleum in the photograph becomes a character in the drama. And the photograph enlarges.
And you can see that photograph at our website, npr.org. Anne Whiston Spern, author of the new book, Daring to Look. She's also a professor at MIT. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
There's an old saying that writers sometimes hear, and it's write what you know. Stella Rimington knows the real world of secret intelligence, counterterrorism, and counterespionage. For nearly 30 years, she worked for MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence agency, rising through the ranks to become the first woman appointed director general. Stella Rimington is now retired from spy work, and she's turned her hand to spy fiction. She came by our New York studios to talk about her new book. It's called Illegal Action. Stella Rimington, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with your main character, Liz Carlisle. Give us a portrait of who Liz is.
Well, Liz is a mid-30s intelligence officer working in MI5, and she finds herself up against a plot coming out of Russia, which is directed against one of what we call the oligarchs, the very rich Russians who are living in London in large numbers, and one of them is under threat from Moscow. And she is a very determined young lady who is anxious, always desperate to sort of get to the meaning of the intelligence which she is working on. She finds it quite difficult, though, because she is sometimes patronised by some of the men around the place, and she is determined that she's not going to be patronised in this way. So she fights back in a fairly sparky way. She brings also a kind of, well, a female intuition, I would say.
Exactly. I was going to remark on that. She gets these moments where she figures something out.
She's got this sort of cool analytical intelligence, but then added to that is this female intuition that enables her to be the first to actually get to the solution.
You write about Liz's time with her bosses in the office, some of them who put her in harm's way because they don't give her all the information she needs. Now, at some moment, she goes to one of her bosses and he dismisses her concerns and he says, if you're frightened, just say so. Can you read a little bit about her response?
Yes. Liz could not believe her ears. Of course she was frightened. What sane person wouldn't be? When she'd read about Tutti's death in the bath, she'd remembered something else, that unpleasant pool of red in her bath at the hotel in Cambridge. But she wasn't going to mention that to Brian. She was damned if she'd give him the satisfaction of thinking she couldn't cope. She felt so outraged that she could hardly trust herself to speak.
And how much of Liz is Stella?
Clearly, some of her is me. And certainly when I first joined MI5, it was a male-dominated world and I had to fight quite hard, to sort of hold my own in the same way she does. And I take some pleasure, I must say, in putting things into Liz's mouth that I might quite have liked to have said, but probably never did, when I was in her position.
It was a surprise to me to read, and I'm assuming this part is true, that there are so many Russian oligarchs who have moved to London, and so this plot can revolve around them. Is it a surprise to you that Americans don't often know that London now has plenty of Russian oligarchs living there?
Yes, I was quite surprised, but certainly in London, many of the best houses, the soccer teams, the best works of art have been bought up by Russians who got very rich under Yeltsin when some of the state enterprises were sold off. And they have come to London and they are spending their money in London. And in fact, I was working on my plot when Alexander Litvinenko, who is not an oligarch but is an ex-KGB officer.
And a dissident.
And a dissident, when he was murdered in an extremely unpleasant way by having polonium put in his tea. And he took a long time to die, and in dying he said that he was quite convinced that this was a plot by his former colleagues in the KGB. And so I felt somehow that fact had caught up on fiction when that happened.
Life was imitating art.
Absolutely.
You are writing in a country that has a fairly strict Official Secrets Act. Do you find that you have to be very careful about what you reveal in your fiction?
Well, I still have to submit my fiction for clearance by my former colleagues to make sure that I haven't inadvertently revealed something that might be damaging to their current operations. But the truth is that the further I get away, you know, from what's actually going on, the less I know of the detail of what's happening, so the less likely it is that I'm going to reveal something damaging. But, you know, sometimes inadvertently I've used a name or a place that is current and they've asked me to change it. Which I do gladly, of course.
There's a real-world debate over whether terrorism should be treated as a law enforcement issue, and there's different views about that between your country and the United States. Do you have an opinion? Do you come down on either side and how this fight against terrorism should go?
Well, in my opinion, terrorism is both a law enforcement issue and an intelligence issue. And in the United Kingdom, our intelligence services don't have any law enforcement powers, so they work very closely with the police. But it's essential, I think, to have intelligence. You've got to try and find out in advance what's being planned if you're going to be able to prevent it. And that's what goes on in the United Kingdom. The intelligence services are working very hard to infiltrate these groups and to try and find out in advance what they're planning. And then, on the basis of intelligence now, people are arrested. One of the problems is that you then have to turn intelligence into evidence if you're going to be able to prosecute people in court. And there's a big debate going on in the UK at the moment about how long people who are suspected of terrorism should be allowed to be held before they are actually charged while the police try to turn the intelligence into evidence. And that, you know, this is a big civil liberties issue in the United Kingdom at the moment.
And in your fiction, it's noteworthy to see how close cooperation there is between even local police, the intelligence agencies. This couldn't happen in an American spy novel.
No, but it is an accurate representation of how things go on in the United Kingdom. And I think it's absolutely essential. Both our Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, and MI5, which is the domestic service, and the police all work extremely closely together. And now they have a sort of joint unit working together so that the intelligence can be shared and the action on the street can be taken.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Stella Rimington is the former Director General of MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence agency. Her new spy thriller is called Illegal Action, and you can read an excerpt at npr.org.
I am Neda Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes.
Our muscles become taut and ready. Our body creates its own natural painkillers. But our abilities to reason and perceive our surroundings deteriorate. Cortisol interferes with the part of the brain that handles complex thinking. We suddenly have trouble solving problems, even simple ones, like how to put on a life jacket or unbuckle a seatbelt.
Author Amanda Ripley interviewed hundreds of people who lived through awful disasters, plane crashes, and terrorist attacks, and she wrote a thinking person's manual for getting out alive. For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Baseball season has passed its midpoint, the All-Star break, For folks headed out to the ballpark and for those who enjoy an armchair and some air conditioning, we turn to Alan Schwartz. He's a sports reporter for the New York Times, and for our three-book series, he has three must-reads about baseball.
When you get right down to it, watching baseball and reading books have a lot in common. Both are made for the summer, both require some investment of time, and the best part, both involve a great deal of sitting. I detest the annual procession of baseball books that simply pine for the old days. My favorite books on baseball do examine the 50s and 60s, but in a much more entertaining way than pure saccharine nostalgia. Vecka's in Rec, the autobiography of the late team owner and impresario Bill Veeck, instantly showcases just how much fun this silly sport can be. Who can't love a guy who writes, "Nothing annoys me more than to be told not to do something because it is lacking in dignity." Veeck rollicks through his days of running the Cleveland Indians, the old St. Louis Browns, and the Chicago White Sox, all the while introducing us to characters such as Satchel Paige, Hank Greenberg, and of course his famous walk-drawing leadoff man, Eddie Gaedel. Veeck dedicated his life to the notion that the fan is king. When I say that my next book is a season-long diary of an iconoclastic pitcher from the 1960s, I bet you'll think I'm talking about Ball 4 by Jim Boughton. Nope. As seminal as Boughton's book remains, Jim Brosnan's The Long Season was the first book ever truly written by a player himself. Brosnan was a lowly middle reliever in 1959, and intellectual enough to read Dostoevsky on airplanes and to smoke a pipe in the clubhouse. But in The Long Season, he shined the spotlight on the inside of a major league team, exposing players' fears of getting cut to their road trip hijinks, although with a greater sense of decorum than Boughton would 10 years later. For example, sex was euphemized as, quote, strenuous exercise, unquote. Reading The Long Season makes one realize just how much baseball in 50 years has changed, but how its overgrown adolescent players haven't much at all. Less inebriated, but no less enticing, is the story told by David Halberstam in October 1964. The book describes the racial overtones of the 1964 World Series between the progressively integrated St. Louis Cardinals and the lily-white New York Yankees. Caught between Jackie Robinson and baseball's current multiculturalism is how the sport only awkwardly embraced its minority stars in the 1950s, and it's telling that the culture clash in the 64 series coincided with the height of the civil rights movement. As only he could, Halberstam tells all the backstories of his tale's major players, Mickey Mantle, Bob Gibson, Roger Maris, Bill White, before ending with a World Series that showed where not just baseball was going, but the United States itself. Lou Brock, one of the Cardinals' African-American stars that year, talked with me one spring training about the grand old game as a societal mirror. Baseball, he said, is the background music to America. Thank goodness books like Halberstam's, Jim Brosnan's, and Bill Veeck's live on to remind us.
And you'll find details on these books about baseball, plus book reviews and author readings, in the book section of our website, npr.org.
Half of the demented things I've ever done, I blame on summer camp. Camp Indianola in Madison, Wisconsin, in my case. Summer camps are often places of sweaty cabins with appropriated Indian names, counselors of college age who'd probably rather be hitchhiking across Europe, color wars, camp shows and songs, short sheeting beds, and other pranks more painful. I'm remembering you here, Jackie Gerstein. Roger Bennett has documented some of the details of summer camp for boys and girls in his book, Camp Camp, Where Fantasy Island Meets Lord of the Flies. Roger Bennett joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
And as I understand it, you spent 3 years collecting essays, more than 80,000 photos from camp life in the 80s and 90s. My gosh, why is camp so interesting to you?
There's probably no better prism to really look at our generation, who we are and how we got to be that way, other than through the summer camp prism. So the book is about summer camp, but it is in kind of the same way as Plato's cave is about prisoners in chains. We're really trying to glimpse the journey of our generation and who we are.
One of the things several of the essays in the book talk about is the fact that in many camps, there really is a severe social order. You've got a phrase written here where you say the cabin could be a place of mental torture in which techniques befitting the CIA's PSYOPs manual were commonplace.
Yeah, well, we documented in the boys' bunk where the physical violence was definitely extremely present, as opposed to the girls' bunk where I think things were a lot more mentally tortuous. We did able to collect over 20 remarkable pieces of violence that were everyday occurrences within the boys' bunk. And the thing that was fascinating about collecting them is that when the people told us about them, they actually loved being on the receiving end because, as one of them said, if you were given a bungee cord wedgie, it meant the counselors noticed you. It meant that you had arrived.
There's a man who actually is on our show a good deal named A.J. Jacobs, who's an editor, of course, at Esquire magazine. And he has an essay in here, which I think will make a lot of people twinge. It's called Dear Scott Blunken. Scott Blunken is a young man who A.J. bullied. A.J. writes, "I'm sorry we mocked your tick, where you puckered your lips every 30 seconds. I'm sorry we bet you 5 Kit Kat bars you couldn't go a whole day without puckering your lips. I'm sorry we spent the rest of the day puckering our own lips and saying, 'Ooh, that feels so good. It's so good to pucker the lips.'" It goes on and on. He emotionally bullied this young man.
He did, and he wasn't alone. And the other part of AJ's essay that puts it into context is that he reveals that he was the victim of bullies in his own school. So this was a group of individuals who'd been bullied coming together to beat up on a kid. But the second point is, at the end of the essay, he reveals that he would never, as a result of this experience, send his own kid to summer camp. So it stayed with him.
Did you have a camp?
I did have a camp. I grew up in Liverpool, England, which was a remarkable place to come of age. And I grew up on a steady diet of Starsky and Hutch, Fantasy Island, Heart to Heart. But I came over when I was 19, expecting to hang out with Huggy Bear in New York City, but being whisked off to Maine, to a wonderful camp, as it turns out, before I knew what hit me. And I'd never seen anything like it. The subtitle of the book is Fantasy Island Meets Lord of the Flies. It truly was a teenage utopia where it seemed to me kids were making the rules for other kids. And there were firsts just occurring all over the place. Kids were learning to shoot the basketball for the first time, to swim the breaststroke, to take the lead in a version of Guys and Dolls. And obviously at night, when it got dark and everyone cloaked themselves in Drakkar or High Karate Aftershave or Charlie or CK, it became a very different place, a sexual petri dish where a whole load of other kinds of firsts were going down. I just found the whole place unbelievable.
Let me quote an essay here from Jamie Denbow. I guess she was at Camp Tel Noir in Hampstead, New Hampshire.
Indeed.
"So many men, so little time," she writes. "This is the sentiment that would go through my head as I applied one last layer of Revlon's pink foil lipstick or gave my deeply sun and damaged locks one more spritz of Aquanet. The social, that twice monthly event that brought boys and girls together, literally together, her iron grip clamped down on his shoulders, his sweaty fingers." Can I finish this sentence? "Delicately lying over her hips." I can't believe any parent listening to our conversation is going to let their son or daughter go to summer camp after the way you've just described it.
I would bet the opposite. I bet that there's parents all over the country listening to this wishing that they could leave their jobs and return to that time and place. And
the parents could do it now that you've got some wisdom.
Well, that was one of the more remarkable parts of doing the book, is that we reunited former bunks, which was not too hard because so many of them are in deep, deep contact still. Listening to them, we realize there's a nation of Americans who on the surface have been able to sculpt seemingly normal lives as lawyers, doctors, accountants and the like, but they're still waiting for the color war cannon to go off at any second, and they'd love to depart from their current reality and go back to that time and place where it felt like anything was possible.
Mr. Bennett, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
Now a review of two collections of short stories by writers young and old. One collection comes from American Evan Connell. It's called Lost in Uttar Pradesh. And the other is by Irish writer Claire Keegan, called Walk the Blue Fields. Here's our reviewer, Alan Chews.
Americans best know Evan Connell for writing the novel Mrs. Bridge, set in his native Kansas City, a book made into the popular film starring Paul Newman. If you look at his career overall, novels, story collections, a best-selling nonfiction book about Custer and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, you can see much of Connell's best work arising from the tension between his early life in his Midwestern home ground and his forays into the far distant exotic. Between Kansas and the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh is how it plays out most vividly in his recently published collection of nearly 24 stories. In the story, The Walls of Avila, a Midwesterner named J.D. travels the world far and wide and sends reports back to his boyhood friends. He had tales of the Kasbah and Tangier, the Kansas narrator tells us, and he had souvenirs from the ruins of Carthage. On his keychain was a fragment of polished stone that he'd picked up from the hillside just beyond Tunis. In the story called The Palace of the Moorish Kings, J.D.'s friends prepare for his homecoming after decades and decades of world wandering. Many of the other stories allow us readers to wander from the South Pacific during World War II to New York, San Francisco, to the Indian cities of Benares and Delhi. The tone is sometimes satirical when dealing with Midwest businessmen or West Coast avant-garde writers, but all of it is calibrated in sentences, sometimes succulent with irony and mystery and the flavor of far distant dreams and locations. Most of these stories have been published in earlier collections. I'd read many of them before and was happy to read them again. If you're trying Evan Cannell's short fiction for the first time, I hope you'll be just as pleased with his Fragments of Polished Stone from Tunis. Now, his stories take you traveling. In Walk the Blue Fields, the second collection by young Irish writer Claire Keegan, you stay close to her home grounds. In story after story, she works in a striking Celtic-slanted prose, bringing news of life in the Irish countryside and exposing hearts and hopes and dreams. As in the powerful title story, in which we meet a doubting priest as he performs the marriage ceremony for a woman with whom he once had a near-life-transforming love affair. As the priest walks across the dance floor after the marriage ceremony, Keegan writes, the bride looks into his eyes. There are tears there, but she's too proud to blink and let one fall. If she blinked, he would take her hand and take her away from this place. The priest ends the night by paying a visit to a peasant shaman. I kept on reading. The story about the dark wages of incest in a desperate Irish farm family. The story about the disintegration of marriages. The story about an isolated young woman's discovery of seemingly magical powers. All the while, this young writer laying out her sentences with native power and depth. Evan Cannell's work is wisely nourishing. Claire Keegan's work is newly astonishing.
Our reviewer, Alan Chews, he teaches writing at George Mason University. The short story collections he was talking about are Lost in Uttar Pradesh by Evan Cannell and Walk the Blue Fields by Claire Keegan.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.